Good evening, everyone. This is Coach Matt, and you are listening to Better Health and Body Radio, your source for the latest and greatest information and understanding in the world of health, nutrition, and performance, where we give you a seat at the table next to the best and the brightest minds to arm you with the information you need to optimize yourself. Join us for another exciting, thought-provoking episode of BHB Radio, starting now. Good evening, guys. This is Coach Matt here with another episode of BHB Radio. We have got a heavyweight showdown tonight in the main event, let me tell you. I'm joined by none other than Tim Noakes from South Africa. For those of you who don't know Tim Noakes, let me give you the tale of the tape. Professor Tim Noakes is a doctor, scientist, author, and educator on health, nutrition, and human performance. Professor Noakes has published more than 750 scientific books and articles. He's been cited over 19,000 times in scientific literature, has won numerous awards over the years, and serves on many editorial boards, including as chief medical officer of the Nutrition Network. Tim still trains and competes in endurance sports to this day at age 71. How's that for a tale of the tape? Today, we're going to get into Tim's journey fighting the medical and academia establishments for preventative health and ketosis to gain acceptance, how the brain regulates exercise performance and fitness, and how ketones improve brain health, thereby improving everything else. We'll get into why Tim is a huge fan of exogenous ketones on the whole, keto's effect on blood sugar, what Tim eats in a given day, why he believes ketosis is beneficial for most of the population. We'll get into how eating meat is vital, and not eating meat is actually what's behind most malnourishment in the world. Tim's current focus with his foundation and work will kind of cap us off there, and how Tim's foundation trains doctors to open up to ketosis, low carb, high fat, preventative health, and how that can change our medical model from the top down. Buckle up, guys. This is an awesome episode. There's a ton of tidbits in there for you guys to implement in your own life, and a lot of just really interesting and inspiring things. So without further ado, let's get this show on the road. All right, Tim, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
No, it's a great privilege. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, of course. I appreciate you coming on. So I know you, of course, and your work. For people at home who may not be as familiar with it, can you introduce yourself?
Sure, Matt. So my name is Tim Noakes, and I'm from Cape Town, South Africa. I was born in Zimbabwe, and we moved to Cape Town when I was 5 or 6 years old. I went to the United States of America as an exchange student in 1967-68, and that was a pivotal year in my life because I went to Los Angeles and had the most amazing year ever, and that really decided me in a number of ways. When I was there, I decided I would study medicine because Professor Christian Barnard performed the world's first human heart transplant in Cape Town while I was in America, and I decided then that if he could do something important, maybe I could study medicine, because up to that time, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. And the second important thing that happened was my best friend in America said he was going to go to university and start rowing or do crew. Mm. And I said, gosh, that's a good idea. I think I'd like to do rowing when I get to Cape Town University. And that's what I did. And then the rowing led to the running, and the running led to everything else. So that was a critical year. So I'm always thankful to the North, to United States of America for having a huge influence on my life. So I came to University of Cape Town. I started studying medicine. At the same time, I was just getting involved in endurance sports. It was at the same time that sports science and sports medicine were really taking off globally. And I was lucky to be on the ground floor. And the effect was that I was much more interested in studying exercise physiology and sports medicine while I was being trained to be a doctor. So I was always looking at, so what am I learning now? How does that, what does that teach me about exercise physiology and sports medicine? And when I graduated, I really didn't know too much about medicine, but I knew quite a lot about sports medicine and exercise physiology. So having graduated, I did a year internship in the hospital as is necessary, and then realized that my interest was in disease prevention and sports medicine, the promotion of health. And that was the career that I started. And I went immediately into research. did my PhD in medicine, then started teaching sports science at the University of Cape Town. We started the first professional course in sports science. And that led over the years to lots of publications, lots of interesting ideas. My two major contributions to the sports sciences were realizing that the brain regulates exercise performance, and we call that the central governor model. And then we described a novel condition called exercise-associated hyponatremia, which occurs when people overdrink during exercise. So in the 1980s, we started to get advised that we had to drink lots during exercise to prevent dehydration and collapse from heat stroke. And we proved that that was nonsensical advice. And in fact, it caused a problem, a much bigger problem, this of overconsumption of fluids. So I wrote a book called Waterlogged, and that was that sort of completed 30 years of research in that area. The other two things I'm known for is a book called Law of Running, which I wrote over 20 or 30 years about the whole history of running and all the physiology and the medicine. And it's been rated the 9th greatest book on running. So it's quite an achievement because it's a book about physiology and it's huge. And it competes with all these autobiographies and lovely stories about great runners. So it was quite an achievement to get quite a lot of recognition for that book. Well, I was doing very well heading towards my retirement. And then in 2010, I made the terrible error of learning that the diet I'd been eating was killing me and that I developed type 2 diabetes. And then I started on the low carb diet and healed my health, improved dramatically. I was able to put my type 2 diabetes into remission. And the credit I got was I got thrown out of my university for being unprofessional.
Oh no.
I got charged by the Health Professions Council of South Africa for being unprofessional and spreading wrong stories about what you should be eating. I lost all my funding. And fortunately, we went to court for 28 days over 4 years, and we won the case 13-0.
Wow.
And that's been called the trial of the nutrition trial of the century. So it was traumatic for the 4 years. It was very traumatic because I was academically bullied and mobbed. In other words, I was completely isolated as an individual. And when they do that, they hope they'll destroy your career because that's what people were looking to do. And anyway, we withstood it. I got some great support from fabulous lawyers, wonderful people who stood by me, and they said that, you know, you tell the truth, we've got to get the truth out. And so we won the case, and it's 2 years down the road now, and I've written all about it, described exactly what happened, and I'm very happy that I went through it now. But it was, as I said, it was tough going through it.
Right. Yeah, almost in one of those, even the hardships kind of help shape who we are and how we are, and you wouldn't take them back after the fact, even if it was very difficult going through it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did have a bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, and for the first year and a half, if I thought about it or someone raised it, I would get a stomach ache and I'd feel sick for a couple of hours. But fortunately, I'm past that now. And it's, I think what helped was we wrote a book about it and that we documented absolutely everything that had happened. And so people who ask about it there, they can go and read about it. And all the people who are bad, all the bad people who did bad things, they're all reported there. They're all listed. And they can't ever get away without that it's historically recorded what they did.
Yeah, that's great. That's great that you are able to have that kind of catharsis and move past that now. I mean, that's, in a way, that's almost like kind of like a Galileo going against the church, right? You know, like back in the day. I mean, it's just more like scientific Gnosticism than it is religious, you know?
Yeah, it was. But I mean, nutrition is religion. So teaching of nutrition, you know, that's what I learned. I learned that nutrition in my country, and I suspect in most countries, is not about science. It's just taught dogmas, doctrines. And these people are not taught how to think and how to argue and taught both sides of the argument. When I talk to dietitians in South Africa who attack me, and I say, well, where's the evidence? And what's the diet you're promoting? Well, it's this balanced diet in moderation. I said, well, what does that mean? And the story ends there. No, you must just eat a balanced diet. So what's that? No, it's a balanced diet. And you can't get past that. What is a balanced diet?
Yeah, that's where it begins and ends, right? So, Tim, you actually said something else that I wanted to loop back on, the central governor role in exercise. Now I kind of came about that a little bit through a company called Omega Wave that does some functional systems monitoring of the body, including basically trying to untangle the brain's role in exercise performance. Do you mind maybe at kind of like a basic literacy for the layman level at home, describing that a little bit?
Sure, Matt. And I think the key is that I'm a generalist. And that's why I was able to make the breakthrough, because I don't really understand the brain all that well. So I'll give it to you as a generalist speaking, and then you'll perhaps be able to understand it without making it too technical. So when I started in the sports sciences, we were told that when you exercise, your muscles run out of oxygen, and that's why you get tired. And so that was the teaching. And then there was this phenomenon that if you tested an athlete, what you should notice is that as they get near the point of exhaustion, even though they can run a little bit faster, their oxygen consumption doesn't increase. So we were measuring oxygen consumption of these athletes, and the technology had just improved, so you could do it second or minute by minute. Whereas before you couldn't do it, you had to stop the experiment and measure the things. But now, because of the computers and automated systems, you could immediately know what the oxygen consumption was whilst the athlete was exercising. And so we observed these tests, and we could never observe, or very seldom observe, what we were meant to observe. So we were meant to observe that the athlete's oxygen consumption reached a peak, and even though he could continue for another half minute or a minute or 2 minutes, the oxygen consumption would stay the same. And what that was meant to indicate was that the muscles had reached, they were getting all the oxygen they could. The heart could no longer pump enough oxygen to the muscles. And the muscles were now becoming oxygen deficient or anaerobic. Your lactic acid levels were rising, and that was causing fatigue. And that was the standard teaching in exercise science since about 1920 or so, when A.V. Hill had come up with this idea. So we couldn't see it. But then, if you tried to publish a paper in those days, you had to say that you saw this phenomenon. So we had a dilemma. We had to say, well, do we want the paper published and say this, that we saw this phenomenon, or do we say we didn't see the phenomenon? And the possibility was that the paper wouldn't get published. And what they would say was, well, you just didn't push the athlete hard enough. That's why you couldn't show this plateau. So anyway, we started publishing papers saying that we couldn't see this phenomenon. And I was invited to the American College of Sports Medicine conference in about 1987. And I reported that we couldn't find this phenomenon. And I said, well, therefore, it doesn't make sense. Something else is stopping the muscles. And I didn't know what it was. I just said, it's not oxygen. There's something else. Maybe something else is breaking down in the muscles. But notice the focus was on the muscles. Then in 1996, I was asked to give the premier lecture at the American College of Sports Medicine. And because I'm a generalist, I thought, well, what can I say? Which is, because generally they would ask specialists who were experts in one particular area, but I'm a generalist. So I said, well, let me look at the topics that I think are contentious in sports science, things that aren't proven beyond all reasonable doubt. And I came up with five models, five ideas, and one of them was that oxygen isn't limiting exercise performance. I didn't know what was, but I just said, here's all the evidence that it's not oxygen. And it was really funny because about a year later, I was going about to speak in Helsinki, and my great friend, the Finnish guy, as I was about to go and start my lecture, he handed me Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, the journal, and he said, Tim, I think you want to look at page 350 or whatever. And I looked at 350, page 350, and I'm about to go up to give the lecture. And it was about how wrong I was about the lecture that I'd given, the American College of Sports Medicine lecture. So, of course, I put the article down and said, well, I've got to think about other things. And I gave the lecture. Anyway, the result was that I went and rebutted that article. And when I was rebutting it, I went and found A.V. Hill's original data, original arguments, which no one had read for probably 60 years or so. And there he said to effect that there, when the body runs out of oxygen, there must be a governor, either in the heart or in the brain, that slows down the circulation, and that then causes the fatigue. And immediately I read that, I knew what he was wrong, but I knew he was right, but he was wrong. Because as a person trained in heart function, I know that if you want to slow the heart's function down, you stop the muscles working. That's the key. You rest the body. So then I said, he's wrong. The governor doesn't exist in the heart. It exists in the brain, and its function is that there's a point in exercise where the brain says, okay, if I continue like this, there's going to be damage, and I don't want the damage to happen. So therefore, I'm going to slow down the recruitment of your muscles so you can't activate all those muscles. And as you slow down the activation of your muscles, your heart rate will come down and your oxygen consumption will come down and you'll protect the system. So that was in very simple explanation of the central governor. We saw it as a physiological mechanism that controlled how much muscle you could activate during exercise. And once we had that hypothesis, it didn't take long to prove that humans never, ever use 100% of all their muscle mass. There's always reserve. And if there's reserve, that tells you the brain's regulating the system. Because if the brain wasn't regulating the system, as you're exercising, as muscles become tired, you'd simply recruit more and more fibers.
Sure.
And that's how you would do it. You would just recruit more and more fibers. And these are fresh fibers so that they would allow you to continue exercising until your point is reached where you're recruiting all the muscle fibers in your legs. And that would be the end of exercise. And we know that never happens. You never recruit more than perhaps 60% of the muscle fibers in your legs at exhaustion.
Interesting.
So that's kind of the basics. And we now know it's a little more complex than that, that during exercise, you don't get just physiological feedback. You also have emotions, and the emotions influence your performance. And then there's the stopping desire or the quitting desire. And that's the intellectual component that you have to decide, is it really worthwhile hurting so much for another hour to win the Olympic gold medal? And that then becomes the question. And ultimately, you have to answer that question. So the physiology is part of it, the emotion is part of it, but the intellect is probably critical in the end. And so my most recent PhD student, that he showed that those are the factors. They're not equal. Probably the physiology is number one. But as soon as you start doubting your performance and your mood changes, and you start thinking, actually, it's not worth it, well, that's the end of the exercise. Mm. And that is not a physiological decision. That clearly is a brain decision.
Interesting. I'll stick to my, like, you know, about an hour of suffering at the gym on my own, and I'll leave it at that before I quit. But yeah, actually, there's a whole lot in there that was interesting, just kind of off the top of my head. There's a sports scientist and coach by the name of Aaron Davis here in the US, and he's been working with that near infrared spectroscopy, the NIRS technology, that it has light waves that can see down to the mitochondria what oxygen's doing. And he basically kind of he felt like the limitation of oxygen getting to the muscle is a little bit overblown when people say so and so has, you know, a bad performance or bad cardio. He felt that sometimes if you were doing a lot of more like strength training that didn't involve relaxation, like heavy grinding, slow reps instead of contracting and relaxing, he felt that sometimes you could create an anaerobic environment where the muscle would reject the oxygen when it would come. And he felt most importantly and most commonly in a lot of cases, if you see, let's say, a fighter
tire out later on, that it was actually like the brain kind of almost going into some type of preferential survival mechanism and shutting down optional systems of the body, like, you know, in this case, fighting or performance or whatnot. So
yeah, well, I would agree that that's what we'd predict. No one's ever shown that. Obviously, if your muscle contracts all the time, then you will get too little oxygen.
Sure.
So that could be a limitation in weight training and so on. But in where you've got a muscle contracting and relaxing, no one has shown that. For example, if you look at a sprinter, in my view, what determines sprinting speed is something to do with the strength in the quadriceps muscles, because if your muscles contract too powerfully, you'll tear them.
Right.
So that has to be the limitation, in my view, in sprinting. So although that the muscle power production is huge, it's not that the muscle is becoming anaerobic. It's that you're just going to tear that muscle if you contracted it fully. So you have to limit it in that way.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, there is a trainer, Jay Schroeder, and he used to do things. He felt like what you said, there was a protective governor on the body. And in some cases, it could be higher if there was some sort of emotional stress or maybe some sort of subconscious belief that the person was going to get injured doing a set activity. And so he would try to replicate things in training, whether it was like, you know, plyometrically or having athletes kind of like, you know, let go of and just drop and catch light weights and try to move them really quickly. And the idea being that by putting the brain in a state of danger, he would get, you know, he would dissolve some of those central governors in a way, because it would you know, you'd have to react to avoid the danger. Almost like if you hear those stories of people kind of moving, you know, maybe it's urban legend, but, you know, someone moving a car to like, help someone who is in danger in it or something like that, you know, he felt it would take something like that. So he tried to replicate that in training, and he did get a lot, whether that was the underlying mechanism or not, he did get good results. So this is all fascinating to me.
I must just tell you one lady who writes me from Stanford, and she was a 5,000 meter athlete, and it was leading into the 2016 or 2012 Olympics, I can't recall which one it was, and she was running a race, and it was the last race for qualification for the Olympics, and she was 60 meters behind. They came to the last lap, and she was 60 meters behind the lead runner, and she looked up at the scoreboard, and she suddenly realized, if I run 65 seconds for this last lap, I'll qualify for the Olympics. So she now no longer was interested in coming second. She just wanted to finish in time to make it to the Olympics. And she took off and she passed the lead woman and won the race. Huh. And she said, I then believed in your central governor model. So she even sent me a picture of this. And it's astonishing watching her just take off and slow and very quickly overtake the lady ahead of her. So that's it. You know, if you change your goal, then you can change the outcome dramatically.
Oh, that's awesome. This is great to hear. I'm definitely nerding out already. Now, I've heard of, you know, the research on exogenous ketones potentially, you know, decreasing oxygen consumption. I'm almost feeling like through dietary measures, decreasing the amount of inflammation in the brain through some of your approaches and perhaps the benefits of ketones on the brain could come into play there, and that having just a healthy brain that doesn't feel like it's under attack could then increase, you know, fitness and human performance. Is that right? Or am I wrong in that train of thought?
Yeah, you know, I don't have any doubt that ketones are hugely healthy. And I remember being in California and was given some exogenous ketones by one of the researchers. And because I'm diabetic, my glucose was a little high that moment. And I took a tumbleful of the exogenous ketones, and my glucose levels dropped by 1 millimole. That's a substantial amount. That was astonishing. And my ketone levels went up from 0.4 to 3 within 30 minutes. So, so what I realized was that the product definitely changes your metabolism. That's point one. And the other point, which I, you know, this is an anecdote, but I was profoundly insulin resistant and I didn't know about it. And the only time I would feel really good was when I went on very long runs, particularly 4 or 5 hour runs. And then I would touch heaven. I mean, literally I would touch heaven. And I'd get this amazing feeling, this high. And what I realized now is I was eating a high carbohydrate diet in those days, but I was insulin resistant. So I was not ketotic at all. And I was always overloaded with carbohydrates. And the only time I got to burn through all my carbohydrates and get to a point where I was now ketotic was when I ran for 4 or 5 hours and didn't eat anything. Mm. And that's when I felt really, really good. And when I went on the low carb diet, I immediately started to recreate those feelings again, which was maybe 20 years later. Wow. And I think all the evidence is that brain function is stimulated with ketosis. And I mean, there's a paper out within the last 2 months or so showing that you can improve brain function within minutes of taking an exogenous ketones. So that's point one. So that I don't question that metabolically have a huge effect, and which has to be beneficial because ketones are beneficial. Where I don't understand the effect is on human performance, because it's very much like if you take glucose, your body generally has quite a lot of glucose and it's available and you've got lots of fat to burn. Why would taking extra glucose make any difference? Because the muscle could always use fat. And so there's some effect of glucose that we can't really explain. And I think it's acting in the brain. And I think it's the same with ketones. You know, if you're fat adapted, you're burning so much fat, the little bit of extra that you got from ketones isn't really going to make much difference. But if ketones acted like a drug in the brain, like glucose does, then you can change, then the whole situation is completely different. Because then it could act specifically at low doses, specific areas of the brain, and change performance. And I think that that's where the research should go. Rather than saying it's a metabolic fuel, it's acting in the brain. And there's nothing wrong with that. That even if it acts like a drug, it's having an effect. And that's what I would look for. And I did advise some of the researchers who are producing the ketones, the type of experiments that they should do to show that effect, and hopefully that those experiments will be done. For example, one of the studies we did to prove that the brain is regulating your performance was we had people exercise at a fixed rating of perceived exertion. So as far as they were concerned, they were working as hard as they possibly could, or within reason. And we would make them say, okay, we want you to keep working at this work, at this intensity of effort, rating of perceived exertion. And we're just going to do it for an hour. So they would exercise for an hour. And of course, their power production would fall progressively during the hour and usually followed a pretty linear pattern. But they were convinced they would do working as hard as at the end as they had at the start. And then we put them in the heat and immediately they couldn't do the same amount of work. They worked less. But they perceived that they were working exactly as hard as they had in the cold, but the work output was substantially reduced. And so that proved to us that the brain is getting feedback. It's the brain's being told, hold it. It's really hot in this environmental chamber. If you work any harder, you're not going to finish the workload or you might die. Mm. So we are going to regulate how much exercise you can do. And that's definitely a brain function. It's coming feedback from temperature sensors in the skin, perhaps in the lungs, and they tell the brain that, hold it, this is a really hot day today, so we've got to be cautious. And so that by the same token, if you want to see whether ketones act on the brain, that's what you do. You have people exercise at the same perceived rating of exertion, and on one experiment they take water and the other one they take the ketones, and you see what happens.
Interesting.
The trouble is you need the water to taste like the ketones, because they mustn't know that they're using the ketones, because they will be biased. We all think that if we're taking something, it's going to make us do better.
Yeah. Maybe some powdered lemonade or something like that. Yeah, that's interesting that you say that about, you know, everything about the glucose and the brain. That same monitoring company, Omega Wave, one of the ways in which they measure is they put kind of like an electrode on your forehead, and in a non-invasive way, They're measuring something called slow cortical potential, or just a resting electrical potential in the brain. And they, while it's not necessarily a perfect measurement, obviously, you know, you can't be invasive measuring someone like that. Yeah. They've correlated their proxy in research with levels of, you know, higher order nervous system function, like vertical jump, and, you know, the volume of, you know, more neurologically coordinated activities, and it's pretty interesting. And then the other thing I did want to hit on was, would perhaps a case for like a, you know, a little addition of glucose, a little extra carbs, be to fuel maybe that ultra fast twitch type 2B muscle fibers? Because isn't the type 2A the one that's fed in a mixed capacity, where you can feed it with both plate and dietary fat as well as carbs, and then the ultra hairline trigger kind of fast twitch, like a sprinter, or when you see like a LeBron James take off to dunk a basketball or something, isn't those super fast twitch fed with purely carbs? Or am I wrong?
Yeah, but the 2A fiber would also use mainly carbs when it was trying to work hard. But you're quite right. The key to performing running really fast is you must activate as many fibers as you can. So you would probably be using 2A and 2B, but the 2B maybe, well, is producing more force. You know, it's really interesting as we go back to the oxygen theory. If you want to run faster, you have to recruit more muscle. And that's what everyone forgot, that it doesn't matter how much oxygen you got available. If you don't recruit more fibers, then you won't run faster. So you're quite correct. The 2B fibers, you'd have to recruit them. But the question is, how do you recruit them? And would giving glucose make it more likely that you recruit them? That's a great question. Yeah, we simply don't know.
Yeah, that would be a good study, like macronutrient ratios and, you know, neuromuscular activation. You know, you could maybe measure it with EMG. Even that, you know, the near infrared, like the muscle oxygen monitors you can put on the body. I've seen those be kind of a stand-in for EMG in many ways. Like basically, it seems to work along the same lines. Now, one thing I did want to hit on that you and I talked about privately before we hopped on was, you said you actually had your first ketone research study when?
Yeah, we did the research in 1978. It was published in 1980 in the Journal of Physiology. And the first author is Dr. Johan Kuslar. And Johan and I were both doing our PhDs at the same time at the University of Cape Town. And we were both in the Department of Physiology at the time. And Johan was a quiet genius who has progressed remarkably. He became a full professor of physiology at another university and really advanced the theory that for type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome, that he was already talking about this idea in 2002, well before anyone else was talking about the role of glucagon in type 2 diabetes. But that's not the point. He came along and he said, you know, the last time anyone looked at ketones in exercise was 1936. Mm. And he said, I'd love to know what causes ketosis. So I said, well, you know, it's really interesting, because then we were running marathons, and how we would train, prepare for the marathon was 6 days before the marathon, we'd eat a low carb diet and we'd do a long run. So we'd go and run for 20 kilometers or whatever, and we wouldn't eat carbs for 3 days. And my wife used to complain and say, you smell terrible. And of course it was ketosis. And I had to read about it and then realize it. So I said, you know, Johan, it's really interesting, because when I do my 3 day carbo depletion, I get very ketotic. My breath starts to smell bad. Maybe it's ketosis. So then we set up an experiment there were two of us, two marathon runners. And this was, you know, it's not often you get a paper published, just two experimental subjects. So what we would do is we would do the 3 day depletion phase, and then we'd go and run on the treadmill for 2 hours. And then we'd go and carbo load, and then we'd repeat the 2 hour run. And then we'd do a day where we just ate normally and didn't exercise. And what we found was that on the day that we didn't eat carbs and we pre-depleted ourselves, our ketones would go to 3 or 4 millimoles. Whereas on days that we did the same amount of running, but we had carbo loaded, or ketones would stay right at the bottom. That then led to a whole series of experiments where we had people do that experiment, and then we would feed them different things. And we discovered that if we gave them either glucose or starch or protein, the ketosis would disappear in half an hour. So we had this lovely way of developing the ketosis and then taking it away. And so then that gave us an idea of that even protein can prevent the ketosis. So those were the experiments. And what was really interesting was when I went back and looked at the data on myself, I found that I had very high insulin levels, particularly when we're on the high carbohydrate diet. So I was clearly insulin resistant. I was just a walking time bomb for type 2 diabetes, which I ultimately got. So anyway, in short, yes, we did ketosis studies then, published them, and really didn't think about them again at all until it's the 2010 when I again started getting interested in ketosis and exercise.
It's funny. That's one of those life coming full circle moments where you get a little kind of signal flare early on. You don't even realize. And then later on, you know, it all comes back to that. Yeah, that was, I think that might be a little bit of a ketone dark ages as far as the mainstream is concerned, you know, the mainstream adoption of it.
In those days, it was all ketoacidosis in diabetes. That's, you know, there wasn't much on ketosis, nutritional ketosis at all.
I can imagine. And now you've people at home might not know this. I'm sure plenty do. You've gotten quite a bit done in your career, including some lifetime achievement awards. Where is your work focused now? What's your kind of mission statement with the Noakes Foundation?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So I retired 6 years ago, and in some degree of disgrace, as you know, because my profession completely tried to destroy my career. So I had to go to court and win my case, and which we did. And we proved that the low carbohydrate diet is both safe and highly effective, and it's evidence-based. And that took 4 years, 12 days, sorry, I was on the stand for 9.5 days, including 3.5 days in cross-examination. So it took me 2 years to prepare myself for the trial. And fortunately, they delayed so long, the opposition, they couldn't get the right witnesses and they got poor witnesses. And I could write the story and learn more and more about it as I went along. Then we wrote the book called The Law of Nutrition. It's available in the United States as Real Food on Trial. And that describes all I did for those 2 or 3 years when I'd stopped researching exercise physiology and it started reading about nutrition. So we published that book, and that the trial ended in 2018. I had written another book called The Real Meal Revolution in 2013, and that really was what got me into trouble with the dietitians, because we were saying that eating carbs was not good for you. And of course, that's the opposite to what the dietitians tell everyone. And so that book earned a lot of money, and we invested it and started the Noakes Foundation. And when we started the Noakes Foundation, there wasn't much knowledge about low carbohydrate diet. So we invested quite a lot of money in research, and we did the first study of liver glucose production in people eating a low carbohydrate diet. And we showed that liver glucose production is completely normal in these athletes. And during exercise, it's completely normal. They don't need any carbs. You don't need to ingest carbohydrate to maintain your glucose if you're an athlete eating a low carbohydrate diet. And the reason is quite simple. You cut off all glucose use in the periphery. You just don't use glucose. You prepare it all for the brain. And there's very little that you need. And the liver can produce more than enough glucose to keep your brain going. So that was an important study. Another important study was we took people who claimed that they'd reversed their type 2 diabetes by reading the book, The Real Meal Revolution. And we were able to show that 75% of the people who claimed that they had reversed their diabetes had in fact done so. So of 28 people, 75% had reversed their diabetes just by reading the book, which is which is quite astonishing.
Wow.
So they read the book, they followed the advice, and they did it. They didn't need any medical interventions. So that was important for us to know that what we'd written was in fact true, because when I wrote the book in 2013, I said, this is the solution for diabetes and metabolic syndrome, but we couldn't be absolutely certain. During the process, we realized that there's so much resistance to this dietary advice in the profession that patients are not going to get this advice easily. And so we realized that the gatekeepers, as it were, are the doctors. And if we can educate the doctors about this, then we can change the future of medicine. And so we've developed the Nutrition Network, which gives certified courses in nutrition for doctors and helps them become coaches and to provide information on diets with all the solid information. So we've got some of the best lecturers in the world have all donated their time to us, and we produced this incredible series of lectures all about the low carbohydrate diet. And I must tell you, so we're trying to develop a global network of doctors who are properly trained in providing a low carbohydrate diet. And I just was thinking the other day, we had a Zoom meeting with 280 doctors and healthcare professionals in Kenya. The Kenyans had set it up in Nairobi, 280 people all around Kenya. And I was fortunate to be able to talk with them, and the Noakes Foundation was involved. And it was absolutely stunning. 280 doctors getting exposed to the low carbohydrate diet and the treatment of diabetes. And it didn't take me to fly to Nairobi. They could do it from their homes, listening into the Zoom meeting. And that's the future. And that's how quickly this information is going to spread. And I was astonished at the knowledge the Kenyan doctors already had about the low carbohydrate diets and how valuable they are for people with type 2 diabetes. So that's our next goal, is to educate doctors and nutritionists and healthcare workers in the value of low carbohydrate diets.
Oh, wow. Because there you're almost taking a top-down approach where these are the people that are going to influence the masses. So you're really going in top down at some level. And obviously, in the United States as well, there's a clear need to have more preventative health measures involved in our healthcare, and we, in many ways, you can give some level of congratulations for the allopathic medicine and the acute care. If you tear an ACL or you need stem cells or something like that, that stuff's amazing. But at the same time, just that the difference between that acute care versus chronic care or wellness care, it's really lacking in this country. And I know it is in other parts of the world too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, because it's not really healthcare, it's disease care, but you make a very good point.
Yeah,
you make
exactly.
A very good point that the medicine of acute trauma and of acute medicine is utterly brilliant, and we should never forget that. But when it comes to chronic disease and prevention, we're hopeless. We're absolutely hopeless because we don't understand that nutrition is the key driver of the problem, and we try to treat it with drugs, which really can't treat it. If you don't treat the cause, you're not going to sort out the problem.
Yep, no, not at all. Yeah, that's really great to hear with regards to, your work and the direction it's taken in the Noakes Foundation. And you're basically, distilling everything that's upstairs in that brain of yours into, professionals that are going to change lives of others. So that's really great to hear. And now,
thank you very much for that.
Yeah, of course. And now, moving on to the next thing that I wanted to hit on as well. I don't know if I could pick on you a little bit and see what your nutrition is kind of like for yourself these days.
Sure. Well, it's very simple. I eat about five different foods. So there's meat, fish, dairy, eggs, cheese, nuts, and a little bit of vegetables. So those are the seven things that I eat. It's very, very simple. I've because I'm type 2 diabetic, I cannot eat more than 25 grams of carbohydrate a day. And so that means no cereals, no grains, no potatoes, no bread, no rice, all those things, no sugar, no sweets, no cookies, no cakes, no ice cream. All those have gone. Oh. And no fruit, all gone. And so it's a very easy diet to follow. And I've been doing it for 10 years and I check my blood glucose twice a day. And so, which I don't need to do. I don't know. It's kind of just become something I do because I'm scared that one day it's suddenly going to get bad again. So yeah, I want to be ahead of it. But once you start testing your blood, you immediately see what things harm your glucose, regulate your blood glucose, and how. Once you got diabetic, I'm so brittle, you know, because I'm so insulin resistant and I ate so much carbs for so long. I'm so brittle. I'm just producing enough insulin to get by on essentially no carbs. But if I have a little bit more carbs, my insulin just so ineffective. My glucose shoots up and stays high for a long time. So absolutely can't do it. So that's why I follow this very restrictive diet. But I don't think it's restrictive. I just love the food I eat.
Right.
So eating steak every day or eating eggs every day and lots of cheese, to me, it's a pleasure. And I don't miss anything.
Oh, yeah, that's great to hear that you enjoy it. I'm the same way. Those are my, and a few others are my favorite foods. Thankfully, I can still have carbohydrates. I'm sure birthdays at your house are not as fun as they used to be without the ice cream and the cake, but you're healthier for it.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did want to hit on a couple other things too. And, you know, of course, be respectful of your time that you've already been so generous with. Where, if you, get someone off the street, let's say, and they're trying to get started with eating like this, trying like a lower carbohydrate, higher fat eating approach, maybe higher protein than they were previously. Where do you usually suggest they begin? You know, what advice do you kind of have for the lay person listening at home who just wants to get started just to optimize their health and maybe get in better shape?
Yeah, I think that the standout support is Diet Doctor, the dietdoctor.com. Started by Andreas Ehrenfeldt in Sweden. And this is a website that has just grown and grown and grown. And I think that all the information you could possibly need is there. You may not want to buy it all, but at least that's a really good start. I think they give away a lot of free information initially. And that is, I think, the most effective and the cheapest source of getting really good information. Otherwise, then go onto the internet and follow various people. But for one particular website, that's a good place to start. It really is. He's done such a good job in getting so many good people to provide information that I think, it doesn't over scientific. It doesn't make it over scientific. It's just good, solid, scientifically based information. And so practical. All the practical stuff is there, the menus and so on, because that's what you need, really. You need some menus and 7-day meal plans to get you going. And that's the key, is to know what to eat for the next 7 days. That's really important. And all the advice for that is on that website.
Got it. Did you say Diet Doctor or Diet Doctors?
Diet Doctor, I think. Anyway, you'll soon see it. It's one not of the difficult. Other. Yeah, dietdoc.com, I think. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Awesome. Or just put in Andreas Ehrenfeldt, Ehrenfeldt. That's his name.
Okay. Sounds good. I can put a little link in the show notes too for everybody. Now, where do you see the future of this all going, whether it's your work or the bigger picture of, using lower carbohydrate, higher fat eating, just in general, or as a metabolic therapy? What do you think the future holds?
Well, the answer is that it is a solution for metabolic syndrome and for type 2 diabetes and for many other conditions. the problem at the moment is it's not getting taught in the medical schools, and that's the problem. And the reason is because the pharmaceutical industry would be devastated if we all went on a low carbohydrate diet, because we'd all start healing ourselves and we wouldn't need their medication. So they can't allow that to happen. And that's why medical doctors are to continue to be taught that this is a dangerous diet, and you know, you've got to take your insulin and eat lots of carbs if you're diabetic. And that is, it's unethical. That advice is completely unethical, because we prove it does harm. And so the doctors are giving advice that is causing harm. But you can't fool all the people all the time. Ultimately, the evidence comes through. If I look back 10 years to when I started, how difficult it was to get information and how doubtful it was, and in fact, how little true information there was. Today, the evidence is overwhelming. You know, as I went to court and defended myself, if I went to court today, it would be 10 times easier to defend myself than it was just 5 years ago. Mm. Because the volume of evidence has just become grown and grown and grown. So if you look forward 5 years, we're going to be in a better position as well. Having said that, that's the information that an individual can get. The problem is that Robert Lustig, who's the great American authority on the dangers of sugar and processed foods, we had a podcast with him a few weeks ago, and he said, Tim, we're 9 years into something that's going to take 30 years. It's going to take 30 years before processed foods and sugar is finally recognized as the cause of all our medical issues. He says, we're at year nine. You know, at least we're not year one. We're nine years into it. But he says, don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take another 11 years at least. Or sorry, I think he meant maybe 21 years if it's going to take 30 years.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. I mean, if you take cigarettes, it took 50 years for them to be realized as harmful as they are. So it's just going to take time, and we've just got to take each individual and change their diets one patient at a time, and they will then influence other people, and then they take it further with that. So it's like a virus, but this virus is slowly spreading. It's not like COVID-19. This one takes a little bit longer to get through the population.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's all super fascinating to hear. On that note too, speaking of, you know, industry influencing nutrition, one final thing I wanted to ask was, I've seen a lot of kind of almost industrialization, globalization, and even fossil fuel companies now almost pointing the finger more at meat for causing environmental harm, when in reality cows are only responsible for about, I think, 2 or 3% of greenhouse emissions, and the overwhelming chunk of environmental, not that there isn't some reform that needs to happen there obviously, but I've always felt that agriculture could be a path forward in the future, like regenerative agriculture, and that fossil fuels and globalization probably held more of the responsibility cards, and that was more of a smokescreen. What do you think about that, just as a concept? And then also, do you think that there's a future in which meat is going to be less readily available?
Yeah, that worries me, coming from Africa, where stunting is very common. And, you know, it's what the problem is that we're being told, the world and the third world is being told what they should eat by these elitists at Davos and the World Economic Forum. Yeah. Who really have no clue what's going on in the poorer countries. And the poorer countries are absolutely dependent on livestock for food and for their livelihood. And so to say we've got to stop eating livestock is ridiculous. The malnutrition we know absolutely is protein malnutrition. And we need to get more protein to the poorest people in the world. And you can either be eggs or milk or meat. Or insects. Insects are another great source. But thinking that we're going to save the world by taking out meat is ridiculous, because you're just going to make people sicker. I'm sick. I've got type 2 diabetes because I didn't eat enough meat in my life. Mm. Now, what's if you take all the people who develop type 2 diabetes on a high carbohydrate diet, what's the medical cost of treating them all with insulin? What's the global greenhouse effect caused by producing all that insulin? And those factors are never included. So you're quite right. Regenerative agriculture is where it has to happen. And I also am very concerned that we can't continue to grow crops without livestock, because the crops are just destroying the topsoil. Mm-hmm. And the pesticides that are needed and those things, the fertilizer, where's it coming from? It's coming also from fossil fuel. So we need to get back to regenerative agriculture. And I think that's another area. I was watching a lovely interview with an American farmer the other day, and they showed that he had gone from growing corn and wheat to increasing regenerative agriculture. And he said, you know, I couldn't make a living on wheat and corn. But with regenerative agriculture, I can finally make a living, which is an interesting point. If it becomes commercially available or viable for people to grow meat rather than wheat, then farmers are going to do that in the United States.
Very interesting. Yeah, that was sort of my concern, is like parsing through and reading through the lines of some of the stuff that the World Economic Forum is talking about with their Great Reset that they're proposing. And it seemed a lot of it centered around, you know, almost like the fourth industrial revolution, like the digital revolution, if you will, further pushing forward what we've seen this year with a lot of the virtual things as a result of the virus. And then the other part, a lot of it seemed to be, you know, environmentally related. And it seemed like they were out of touch with the whole meat piece. It seemed like they were really pushing less meat, and then also maybe the option of lab grown meat. And, you know, it sounds, hopefully we're not headed for a Soylent Green kind of society, if you're into science fiction at all.
Yeah, it's very worrying. But there's a new book out, Sacred Cow, which I think is fantastic, because it gives you a fairly balanced view of what contribution does meat make to global warming and so on. And it's a balanced view, and it's marginal. Fossil fuels are the problem, and right, the cows are just being used as an excuse. And what I'm glad to see this week, that the fake meat industry is struggling, that the sales are down, and the market value of the stock is falling. So maybe we've got past that little story. I mean, we'll never get past it. There'll always be vegans and vegetarians, which is fine. But sure, They'll never be in the majority. They'll always be a very tiny minority of the population.
Yeah, I agree. I'm all about freedom to eat. If that's what you would like to do, you know, feel free. It's more so, it seems like I was more concerned about industry taking over and funding the scientists and the research to influence a population into, you know, almost guilt tripping them into, and, you know, industry into, I guess, bullying them is maybe the better word, into, you know.
Yeah. I think, let me just make the point again, that just come to Africa and see the malnutrition and the stunting. And we all know it's protein, lack of protein in the diet. So if you're going to cut protein from animal sources, you're just going to make stunting worse. And that's, to me, is the final decision. You have to have animal produce, animal protein in the diet to prevent stunting. And if you don't have it, you have poor children who are not developing their brains, not developing their full capacity. So we have to solve that problem. And it's not going to be solved by producing fake meat. And
absolutely.
And all those arguments. I mean, I'm a strong believer that the green movement is to fund various individuals like Al Gore, is going to make a fortune out of the green offsets. And it's got nothing to do with your health or my health or the health of the globe.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, for example, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, he has become involved. He bought an arena, climate change arena. He's been talking about that more. But I kind of feel like if you truly care about the environment, you tend to care about all aspects of it. It's plastic in the ocean. It's burning down the rainforest. It's species extinction. It's not just one silo of, you know, climate change. And it seems to be like some people like him are sort of pushing that as an issue, not necessarily because they're environmentalists, but more so because they would like to, you know, have kind of a justification to replace their workers with AI, which is also part of, you know, the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, I agree fully.
You know, things like that ultimately put a lot of the masses out of work, unfortunately.
Exactly.
I could talk to you all day, but I want to be, you know, you've already been more than generous with your time. If people want to learn more about you and your work, obviously there's everything from books on running to your foundation. Where should people go for that?
Yeah, I think probably the Noakes Foundation website, you'll be able to see, although it's not designed there to promote me, it'll give you some idea. The goal of the Noakes Foundation is to promote the idea low carb diet is important and that nutrition is important in health promotion. But you'll get a feeling for what we've done from reading that. So I would advise people go to the NoakesFoundation.com, I presume. Maybe it's .org. And then you can read what we do.
Awesome. That sounds great. And I recommend, as someone who's, you know, visited it myself, who's learned from Tim from afar, I highly recommend checking that out. You also, if you're really excited by the things we were talking about today and, you know, being part of, you know, if you got change for a paradigm, as they say, helping push this along, feel free to donate on there to push along any of these research studies too, and just to the foundation in general. So, all right, Tim, thank you so much again for your time. It's been an honor having you on, and I hopefully I get to talk to you again in the future someday.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for a lovely interview. Lovely to chat to you, and thanks for your most interesting questions and bringing my story to the public. I really appreciate that. And to your listeners, just believe that the low carbohydrate diet is very beneficial for the majority of people. And the evidence is very, very strong. I went to court to prove it, and we achieved that. So please benefit from the health outcomes of eating this better diet.
Well said. Yeah, Tim had to fight the power, so don't let him have fought the man in vain. All right, guys, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of BHB Radio. That is Better Health and Body Radio. I appreciate you guys inviting us into your home, and I will see you here next time. Thank you.